Hello, everybody out there in podcast land, and welcome to the Front Row Flashbacks, a part of the Front Row Network and NPR Illinois Community Voices. I am Ryan Lutens, diehard horror fanboy and all-around Academy Awards snob.
I'm Jay Hoffman, master of the dad joke and interpretive dance.
And I'm Erin McCabe, the peace bringer and insightful mama hen of the show.
Here on Flashbacks, we like to get all nostalgia-like about the movies of our past. Movies from the 80s, 90s, and early 2000s that have shaped the way we look at cinema and pop culture today, and how those movies have given us insight and hope in our everyday lives.
So strap on your fanny packs,
hold on to your butts,
and let's get ready to flashback. If you've ever been involved in a love triangle with a cute rich boy and your annoying stalker of a best friend only to have your father's financial situation create relationship drama, then you might be thinking about Pretty in Pink. Welcome to another episode of Flashbacks. We are here to celebrate Valentine's Day, and why not choose a great teen drama from the 1980s that's celebrating its 35th anniversary, Pretty in Pink. We've got our flashback crew here tonight. Erin, how's it going?
Good. I'm excited to go up against you and Jay, all about Pretty in Pink.
Oh yeah, we'll talk about what we mean by that shortly towards the end. But before, we got a lot to get into. But Jay, how's it going?
Oh man, I have a baby. I don't sleep ever. I just started back at work again. Does it get any better than this?
So you have no life?
Please, God, tell me it gets better than this.
All right, well, we're going to dive into John Hughes's Pretty in Pink, but before we get down to the nitty-gritty stuff, we got to go through our normal routine. Jay, give us the rundown.
All right, Andy, the poor girl from the wrong side of the tracks. Literally, they keep showing us those tracks over and over, so we know she's from the wrong side of them. Well, Andy works at a record store with Janine from Ghostbusters and is plagued with aggressive boy attention. Whether it be her best friend Ducky, who is torn between a constant stream of bad jokes and aggressive flirtation, or the uber-hunky version of James Spader, who is quick to point out that she must be a bitch since she's not into him. Finally, Blaine comes into the picture. He's a rich kid, but the good kind, and he and Andy make awkward eyes and even more awkward conversation to become the apple of each other's eyes. Will their relationship survive sabotage from Steph guilting Blaine about being with a poor? Or Ducky making her feel bad for not being with him? There's only one place to find out if true love exists in a 1980s teenage romance movie, The Prom.
And this all takes place within the last 20 minutes of the movie, but I'll get into that later. All right. We need to know about this movie. Erin, hit us with the facts.
Fun facts. This movie, although most people think it was directed by John Hughes, it was actually directed by Howard Deutsch. It was written by John Hughes. In its cast, you've got Molly Ringwald, the darling of the 80s, as Andy. Harry Dean Stanton as her father, Jack. John Cryer as her best friend, Ducky. Annie Potts as her employer and best friend, or best girlfriend, Iona.
Scene stealer.
Iona.
Scene stealer, that's all I was saying.
Yeah, she's great. James Spader is Steph. Andrew McCarthy is Blaine.
Okay, so I have to enter. Do you guys know that Gina Gershon was one of the mean girls? Did you guys catch that?
I did. Totally did. I did not remember her from my first viewing. And then she popped up on screen and I was like, oh, Gina Gershon. She looks so gorgeous still.
And the original Buffy the Vampire Slayer, the good one. I want Larry Smith to know, the good Buffy.
She's Ducky's girl at the end.
Yeah, Duckette, as she's credited.
Oh, God.
Oh,
all right.
Boy.
Rolled the fun back. I almost ended us right there. We're almost done.
Oh my gosh. Ryan's not going to make it through the episode. And Jay,
I'll get to that in a second.
This movie had an estimated budget of $9 million. It made $6 million opening weekend in the United States, and it grossed domestically $40 million. Cumulatively worldwide, it only grossed $40.479 million. So it literally made $9,000 in the global market outside of the U.S.
I thought that was interesting, because I then wondered, I wonder what the rest of like the John Hughes teen movies look like outside of the States. Like, is it a very state-centric type of movie? And I don't know. I don't know the answer to that, but it got my brain going.
Yeah, or like, you know, do movies like this, like, were they picked up in Canada but nowhere else? Because I could see this not really translating into other cultures in the 80s at the time, and now I doubt anyone's gonna pick it up and be like, I need to see the classic Pretty in Pink.
It would slay in India. They like the caste system.
Rolling there.
Unclean. Unclean.
Oh my god. It's got a Rotten Tomato score of 75% and an audience score of 81%. It was filmed at the Los Angeles High School where Grease was made in 1978. And I did notice some of those hallways looked familiar. The filmmakers wanted Blaine to be a hunky square-jawed jock, a la Jake from 16 Candles. But Molly Ringwald wasn't attracted to that sort of guy. Ringwald had some say in the casting, and after Andrew McCarthy auditioned, she told John Hughes and Howard Deutsch her thoughts on him. That's the kind of guy I would fall in love with. Okay, now I'm feeling some feelings about that. They thought he was a quirky guy and weren't interested, but Ringwald pushed for his casting. James Spader was offered the role of Blaine, but he chose to take the role of Steph instead. He finds it more fun to play the villain.
Thanks, Ultron.
Right? He basically plays the same role. We can get into that later, but I feel like
Steph is Ultron.
Steph, that's how Ultron was born, from right. Steph.
1985, 1986.
Totally. The genesis of this project emerged when Molly Ringwald asked John Hughes to write a movie based on the psychedelic Fur song, Pretty in Pink, which was her favorite song at the time. In spite of their chemistry on screen, John Cryer, who plays Ducky, has stated that both his co-stars, Molly Ringwald and Andrew McCarthy, found him irritating from day one. Cryer, who describes himself as a very outgoing person, believes his attitude was the reason he never got along with the very reserved Ringwald and McCarthy.
keep telling himself that.
Yeah, that's three of us that found him irritating.
All right. Well, thank you for those fun facts. It is no surprise on the network that whenever I happen to partake in libations, it's because I'm somewhat irked by a film. So I am doing classic flashbacks here, and I'm drinking a Coors Banquet. Thanks, Cobra Kai. But let's dive into this discussion of this great movie. I'm a little upset that Robert Downey Jr. wasn't cast because, well, we'll talk about that. First memories of the movie. All right. Let's go with Jay first.
It would have been sometime in high school myself. But I don't remember this one as well as some of the other 16 Candles and Breakfast Club. Definitely. I watched way more. What I do remember is I didn't care for this. I liked it better this go round than I did then. I'll say that. I didn't care for it as much. I do think it stands out from kind of the rest of that genre, like with John Hughes' involvement and the teenage thing. It's not quite as fun or goofy. I think it's a little more real, you know. It's like, man, the awkwardness of everybody in this movie, that's like real teenagers. Like, real teenagers are not the Breakfast Club, just all super charming and know exactly what to say, and it's just not that way. So I thought that was cool, but you know, then it's like Fast Times did it better. So I don't know. I liked it. I just, it didn't, it wasn't one that really stood out to me amongst this genre.
All right, Aaron, how about you? What was your first thoughts?
Oh no, Ryan, I want you to go.
Okay. All right. So I do not remember the first time I watched this movie.
I bet it was on TBS.
No, I believe it was. I think I remember it was in college and somebody just wanted to have a John Hughes marathon and they brought up this movie. So it was on and I was present, but I very well could have been intoxicated at that point. So I remember it, but I don't remember it. So I would consider my go-to for this podcast to be like my first, my awakening to it. And I've got some issues. You know, I do remember when I watched it, you know, whether it was in college or whatever, I do remember the scene where Ducky is dancing around in the record store. That is classic. That is, you know, it's a very classic image. And of course the soundtrack, but we'll talk about that. But yeah, other than that, just nothing really stood out to me. And then when I sat down and watched it again, it kind of felt like the first time all over again. So, I mean, that's my thoughts. It just didn't really stand out to me. So, mm-hmm. Aaron?
The year was 1996.
Hold on, wait. I'm going to go put my snooze on so that way I can wake up.
No, you know, this was a movie that I went over to my girlfriend's house, my best friend's house in high school, freshman. I was having sleeping over at her house on Friday night, and it was like, we're watching Pretty in Pink. Her older sister was 3 years older than us, and her friends were over, and they wanted, you know, that was a big, they were big fans. So, you know, we were always like watching Pretty in Pink, Grease, like all of the, you know, John Hughes movies, even though this is a written by John Hughes film. But it was a Friday night, watched it, put it on. You're in high school, feel like you're in it. You're like, oh my God, I relate so much. You know, that was my first viewing. I can remember the color of the carpet, the TV screen, the TV in the corner of my friend Katie's house. So I remember that experience very much, and she really loved the movie. When I first viewed it, of all the characters, I of course loved Iona. I of course loved Andy, but Ducky was one of the characters that stuck out to me more than Blaine. I like my quirky characters.
That's why you're on this show.
That's why I'm on this show. But watching it, you know, I just reviewed it again because that's what I do when, unless I haven't seen it and then I watch it the day before the episode recording. But I realized upon viewing it the second time that I have some reconciliation to do with teenage Erin on her choices. So it was just funny to view it this time with a very different lens and actually learn a lot about myself, which we can talk about when we get into the characters. But I had a different perspective this time than 14-year-old Erin watching it.
I'm not going to lie. I feel like it's going to get a little weird based off of that. We'll get to it later. I'm hoping you're going to say you realize that Steph was the real hero.
Oh my gosh.
He's that, so cool. He smokes all the time.
Dude, everywhere.
He is the epitome of 80s.
He was smoking in the school.
He basically
was smoking at the prom.
Smoke in the school, look disdainfully at people, and wear linen suits.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, yeah. Nailed it.
Beautiful hair.
Beautiful hair.
They probably just told him, like, act 80s. And he's like, I am the 80s. Let me show you. Frickin' Spader. All right. Let's dive in, okay? Let's talk about what we liked about the movie. Aaron, we're going to let you go last since I think you're going to have a little bit more to say. Jay, what are some things that you really enjoyed when it came to Pretty in Pink?
First of all, love the soundtrack. Love the music to it.
Yes.
Kind of goes along with most of these movies, but this one's no exception. What I did like, it's a thing about this movie that kind of tears me, is I think it gave a voice to like those real awkward teens. Sometimes these movies, you get the impression that when you're a teenager, that every teenager is the wittiest, smartest, smarmiest, coolest. Yeah. And this one, they just like everybody, I'm making fun of Steph because he's such a dick, but like Steph was like, felt like a fully fleshed, real person. Mm-hmm. And that's what I liked. I really liked that it felt real. It didn't have kind of, there's a couple elements, but generally it didn't have much of that goofy cartoon stuff that makes John Hughes movies really fun. But I think this just showed another side, and that he was able to really, John Hughes and his writing was able to tap into a lot of different elements of, teenage angst at the time. And I think this is just another element of that. I also, the cast is killer. And they're all good. I really do find Ducky annoying, but I think that's a testament to John Cryer. I think he did a good job. He's knockoff Ferris Bueller. And I think that's fine for the movie. I think that fits in much better. Like
the
he's
poor what man, Ferris Bueller.
Yeah, wrong side of the tracks, that schmuck.
Resume.
Well, he's what Ferris Bueller probably would have actually been like in real life. like he thinks he's super cool and super charming and can pull this stuff off, and really he's just a little odd and quirky and weird. And Harry Dean Stanton, he's the guy you get in the 1980s when you need a parental figure that's not a caricature. Like, oh, we need a parent that seems like a real human. Boom, get Harry on the phone.
Dude,
like Don, come on, man.
In the beginning, when he goes back to bed, I'm like, as a parent now, I'm like, I feel that. Like, I know that.
And then, like you said, Annie Potts, everybody was so good. And I think the teenage awkward love between Andy and Blaine, like, it was awkward. They didn't talk much.
No.
They, like, make eyes, and then they smile, and then they make eyes, and then they smile, and then they're confused it's why they don't both immediately love the same stuff. And
right.
But so I think the cast was great. I think it was a different side of the teenage angst in the 1980s that they showed. And the music was killer. Those are the things that I liked.
I have to agree with everything that you said. The soundtrack was phenomenal. And the fact that the ending was changed, and that somebody tell me the name of the band that did the last song. What they may know.
OMD. Orchestra Maneuver in the Dark.
The fact that they were able to, with the rewrite of the ending, and we'll talk about this in length, the fact that they were able to take that ending and completely make a new song that fits, and that's, of course, If You Leave, it's a testament to the soundtrack. But this cast is phenomenal. Annie Potts is just a scene stealer. Every scene that you're in, you just are so you're anticipating her every moment because it's gold. I love the fact that her style changes every scene and she is her own person. But she doesn't go out of her way to be her own person. She's just it. And that's fantastic.
She's just cool.
But I love at the end, though, she changes everything to be with a guy that she likes. And so it's almost like, for Andy, that's something. And I really enjoyed that. But man, this movie hits the style. I had to say it. Yes. This movie nailed 80s style. I like that Andy is almost like a designer. I wish they would have explored that more. I'll get to that in my improvements because I think this movie was very rushed at the end. But we'll talk. But the fact that, they're not giving her enough credit in that aspect. It's mentioned and that's it. And then it just looks like, you just look at her outfits. But Blaine, if you notice, James Spader, Team Steph over here, James Spader has his shirt unbuttoned in every scene. Like that's pure 80, like that's Miami Vice style right there, you know? But every scene you watch, he's got his shirt unbuttoned. And I know this because I looked on IMDb. Okay.
Sure you did, pal.
Not because I was counting. Okay.
The neighborhood Mr. Skin over here. Yeah.
Right. but no, I just, you know, this cast was fantastic. I think it worked. I did read something that Robert Downey Jr. was up for Blaine, and Molly Ringwald said no, which I want to know what kind of clout. I get that Molly Ringwald was the it girl of the 80s, but seriously, to run like the casting department?
I mean, okay. She, I found out, and correct me if I'm wrong, but like she got offered roles for Ghost. She got offered the lead role. Like I couldn't believe the lead roles she got offered. Like she really shot into stardom. So I guess it would maybe make sense that she had as much pull as she would, or maybe John Hughes felt as the, I mean, he was the writer and the producer, not the director, but like, I don't know, as far as chemistry went, they really wanted to make sure that she was gonna hit it with somebody.
Yeah.
I would argue this is not surprising to me. 16 Candles had already been out. Love had already been out. And she was known as John Hughes's muse. Like, whatever Molly wants, he's going to take care of it. And as the producer, he's going to be able to take care of that. So I don't know. I think it's the fact that Aaron pointed out, she was offered those other roles, maybe didn't take them. And her stardom, you know, kind of faded with the 80s, even though, I mean, she's still, you know, she's still on TV shows and stuff. I mean, she's still a pretty...
Hey. Not another teen movie. Great.
She's Archie Andrews' mom on Riverdale.
Hey, not another teen movie was fantastic, okay?
She is Archie
Captain Andrews America's mom in that
on Riverdale now. On the CW right now.
Well, I like Sabrina, so I know they're kind of like
there you
similar
go.
Shows.
Yeah, they're only a town away. Greendale's only a town away.
Yeah.
From Riverdale. All
right. So yeah, maybe with like time, her, you know, because she is the 1980s, and I didn't talk her up when I was talking to all the extras, because who needs to? It's Molly freaking Ringwald.
Moral of the story is, we hear flashbacks, we love Molly Ringwald. It is what it is. We love her. But no, between the acting and the soundtrack and the style, I think this movie was very, very well done in that aspect. Other things I have issues with, but we'll talk about that. Aaron, what are your takeaways?
I think this movie does a couple things really, really well. Like you said, 80s style. Obviously, we've already harped on the love for the soundtrack. I think it really nails the mean girl stuff in high school.
I was just thinking, like, I forgot to say that. Like this movie does a really good job showing social circles in school. You didn't really get that with other John Hughes movies. This one a lot more.
Yeah, you get that. And a lot of times you'll hear girls, you know, I can't speak for kids in school now, but like a lot of times we kind of say as women that women are usually worse to each other than men are worse to women, as far as the like picking on. And I think this movie, like, yeah, Steph's a huge jerk, but like, the girls throughout the entire movie are terrible to Andy. You know, like they're pretty relentless themselves. And there were aspects I just related to in the story, as far as I grew up going to a private Catholic school in grammar school and high school. But in grammar school, there was a really interesting thing as far as the whole like, on the other side of the tracks thing. Now, we all could never tell how much money anybody had because everyone was in a uniform, so everyone looked the same. You know, in public schools, you could tell by people's clothes, right? So that was always important to be like, I need to have new clothes, or I want to because I don't want to stick out. Like, I'm a poor kid or I don't have anything. But we had a weird thing when, like, kids who attended public schools were actually pretty mean to the kids who attended private schools, at least where I lived, because the idea was that we were all rich kids. So like we'd have a dance at a park district and the public school kids would pick on us because they thought we were rich kids. So it was really interesting dynamic. And like, that wasn't the case. Sure. Some people had more money. Some of them were just like, you know, families who had moved out of Chicago and they had gone to Catholic school and they just wanted to carry on the tradition. And they worked their butts off to get their kids into that schooling because they wanted religion, you know? So it was just sort of like kind of interesting to see that and then like remember it. Cause I mean, when I was when I was 14 and watching it, I wasn't thinking of that, but I don't know if that was an experience of anybody else. I don't know if anyone else like experienced the whole like poor kid, rich kid in school. You know, so I don't know. I thought that was I think it's fascinating, at least for me, like for a personal experience. But I mean, I like the movie. It's a great teen melodrama of the 80s, but it's not my favorite. It's not my favorite quote unquote Brat Pack, quote unquote John Hughes 80s teen movie.
Okay. And
I was listening to everything, but I was stuck on what's grammar school?
That's what we call it in Chicago.
See, you are fancy. You're trying to.
Oh my gosh.
I mean, I went to a Catholic school, but I didn't go to a Catholic grammar school.
Grammar school.
Oh, I forgot. That's a Chicago thing. So in Chicago. So what's really funny is like literally every eight blocks, like in the city limits, there used to be like a church, Catholic church, and a school associated with it. And those were the parishes and you called them grammar schools. And so what was funny is that we would all know, like when we got to high school or even when I went to college and like there was a large portion of students from Chicago, you would ask, what grammar school did you go to? And that's how you knew where they lived. And like everyone, the same thing, Jay, anyone who went to a public school was like, what's a grammar school? Like, what kind of crap are you talking about?
Are you learning to be a writer? What are you doing?
No wonder those public school kids were picking on us thinking we were rich at a grammar school.
Well, just because you think you can conjugate a verb better than me makes you better than me?
You ain't so bad. You ain't so bad. Yeah, I went to a little podunk. You know, I graduated two towns together, 35 people. So we didn't, that really wasn't a thing. And that's why, like, some of these movies are hard for me to relate to. But I grew up in kind of a pretty crappy house, real small. So like I could associate, you know, understand Andy's perspective on things and not wanting people, you know, she didn't want Blaine to see her house.
Oh, I used to.
I had one of those. I had that. I didn't like people coming to my house.
Me too. I wouldn't let people come over to my house. That caused me a lot of anxiety. I had a very chaotic childhood and adolescence, and it was very messy. And I 100%.
Jay, I have a very serious question for you.
Yes.
Did you live by a train track?
Well, here's what I'll tell you. I didn't live by a train track that existed anymore, but Ashland, Illinois used to be a crossroads town, baby. We had train tracks going everywhere, and we found railroad ties in our backyard buried in the ground. So
that's cool.
Awesome. Yeah, I guess I did, even though
stick that in your pipe and smoke it, Ryan.
It's a great way to set up exposition in your life story. All right, let's move on. Let's talk about, you know, where we could see potential improvements when it comes to Pretty in Pink. I'm going to save my shtick for last. Aaron, you went last time. Let's let you go first.
This is always hard for me on flashbacks in the sense of like these movies are made at a certain period of time where certain things are acceptable. You know, that wouldn't be they're not acceptable today. So it's interesting to hear some of the lines. So for me, improvement's always hard. I think that there's a lot of lines in here that if you remade this movie in 2020, you just like, or 2021, you're like, no, that cannot be in there. Like that's like the so inappropriate. What?
Like the candy machine line.
No, I mean, that was great. That was brilliant.
There's like, There's like 1,000 lines in this movie.
That when Ducky gets thrown into the girl's bathroom, and he goes, "You guys have a candy machine in here?"
Oh my god!
Talking about the tampon machine.
Offended by, you're not offended by the fact that the first thing Ducky says to the women that are the girls in the school is, "Hey, I can get you guys pregnant by Christmas."
Yeah, that's a little rough. That one's a little rough.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, yeah.
Another introduction to Ducky, but I'll get into that.
Right. But again, these are things that were acceptable in the 80s, right? So it's hard for me to be like, yeah, would I want them improved? But like, they were appropriate at the time, so I'll leave them. I wish, like you guys have said, the relationship seems so rushed. The movie's an hour and 38 minutes, but it's like, it's really weird how like they, Blaine and Andy don't talk and interact a whole lot, and then they get super serious for like 15 minutes. They're like hardcore in love, and then they kind of have like a quick falling out, and you know, and then all of a sudden it's prom, and it just feels really strange how they weave in that relationship or lack thereof for as intense as it gets. You guys know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I'll elaborate later.
That's like my biggest improvement. Everything else, that's like, I don't know. That kind of really bothered me this time, or I noticed the most this time.
All right, Jay, what do you think?
No, I agree. I wonder too if it seems like a lot of the movies of that time were shorter. It seems like we're a lot cooler now with the longer stuff. And I think you tack on 20 minutes to this movie, 15, 20 minutes. And you can do some good relationship exposition because yeah. At the end, you know, we're going to talk about Team Ducky, Team Blaine's. Like, the relationships didn't feel fully fleshed out. Andy and Ducky's relationship was weird. You know, it was weird. And then it was weird. And then her and Blaine, it seemed like a budding romance,
right?
But we didn't quite get the romance to earn the fight, like you're talking about, to earn the falling out and the split.
Well, it went from like budding to like flowering. Like it went through four seasons in like the time it would take to go through one season.
Yeah. And it did, it really wouldn't have taken that much time.
Right.
Do a quick little, some clips of them going on some date, man, play some 80s bangers over the top and show them having some fun and doing stuff and
running around holding hands.
Yeah.
Sticking in a good 80s song.
A montage.
Sometimes.
Put them in a mall. It'd be great.
Yes.
Okay. So you guys are echoing my sentiments, and I've been thinking about this for quite some time. This movie is just a jumbled mess and a quickly written story. This is a film about relationships, and this film doesn't offer us a single solid relationship except for Andy and Iona.
Wait, no.
Maybe her father. What? I just said her dad.
Oh, okay.
Dad. Okay, yeah. Okay, good. So that's it.
I disagree. You know?
Hold on.
Okay.
Well, fully formed relationships in terms of, you know, mutual, you know, but that's beside the point. The biggest thing is that you have Andy and Blaine together, and then Andy and Blaine are not together. Andy designs a dress, which we see for the first time, even though it's already been mentioned, you know. Then we see her go to the prom. Very little prom exposition and the movie's over. I get that the ending was redone and we'll talk about that, but this movie is about relationship and fleshing out those relationships, and it just seems very rushed and it just seems like there was more story to tell. Jay, what were you gonna say?
A lot of relationships in there.
But they're not brought to fruition.
You only have
between her and her dad and her and Iona.
I'll be honest. I think what I was looking for with Ducky came at the end, but I think that it was a confusing relationship because at first It almost seemed like Andy didn't even know him.
Again,
I see. Yeah, in the beginning.
Then
yeah.
they're kind of hanging out. Then it's like, oh, they are friends. They're just kind of weird. And it's because he makes it weird. But I think the ending, which we're going to debate later, I guess, I think that flushes out very well her relationship with Ducky. And I'll tell you why. Ducky stops being a creepy asshole and starts being a friend.
But yes, that's right at the end. But that's right at the end. What if he was a friend and he was really interested in Andy, when was he going to stop being a dick? Because
he was
a dick.
He was also a boy in love with a girl he had known his whole life and had never told. And
what? That's all he did the whole time.
So if he really cared about Andy, then why is he going up to two random girls saying he's going to get him pregnant by Christmas? Like, that's not...
No, he did some super... Don't give me... I'm not defending that behavior.
he was just doing a peacock dance.
He was just being a high school boy.
No, but I think the point that they were trying to make with him was, like, the awkward boy energy of, like, you're in love with your best friend, but, like, kind of jokingly telling her, even though it is in, like, a stalkerish way.
Was he joking?
There were times when...
He straight up told her to her face, I love you.
Okay, yeah, but then, like, why did he have that whole scene on her bed where he was like, do I tell her? How do I tell this woman that I love her?
Because I don't know. Maybe he didn't think he was laying it on thick enough.
It was as thick as peanut butter.
Here's the thing I'll argue.
Well, I just need to
I think it's a story about a guy who thinks he's in love with his best friend.
But here's the thing. We don't even know their relationship because it just seems so awkward from the beginning. This is a movie that's supposed to be a love story and a love triangle, right? But we're not getting any. I get that we get the triangle, but we're not getting the relationship part. We're friends and he's gaga over her.
A love triangle is usually like, oh, who do I pick? And I don't ever feel like she was ever going to pick Ducky.
Never. Right. Because they were never in love. Neither of them were.
Not really a triangle. It's like a triangle and like one of the edges fell off.
It's now an isosceles triangle.
Yeah, exactly. It's now just like a zigzag.
You know, and Ducky coming through the end was just, she used that as a self-confidence. I have my friend. Whereas Ducky's still thinking, hey, I'm going to score because I got the girl on my arm. But for her, it was a friend being there. But we don't get that. We don't get that understanding of that type of relationship, you know, because she never allowed Ducky to be there for her. Do you guys see that? Like,
I don't know. I think he just laid it on so thick, man.
That she gave up?
No, I think it was just like, this is my quirky friend. We're friends. He drives me batshit crazy sometimes, but we're friends.
Okay, I see
that. Right? And he's got my back, but sometimes I'm like, I'm over it. I'm like, I'm not really ready for the 100 miles an hour, nonstop crappy jokes. I'm not interested in that.
A lot of crappy jokes.
But what I think I liked what happened to Ducky at the end, because I think he realized there was no like love of that. I think he realized it's like a different kind of love. I think he realized that to be a good friend, you know, he had to recognize the kind of relationship they had. So I thought he had a lot of growth. It's just, he's so damn annoying getting there.
Yeah. He starts off super immature. Very, very immature. Like when I was watching it this time, I'm like, holy shit, 14-year-old Aaron. But
what are you thinking? Thinking about dating Ducky?
Have you changed your mind?
I love Ducky. I love him so much. But like 14-year-old me had a super chaotic household, and like what Ducky offers throughout that film is 100% certainty that you are loved exactly the way you are and in your background. And yeah, he's super annoying, but like I could see that like as a high school girl watching that movie, and if you're looking at who to pick or like what team are you on, like yeah, Ducky's annoying, and now as an adult I'm like, holy shit, he is pretty stalkerish. But like for a 14, 15, 16, 17-year-old girl watching that, and if she's got any insecurities or unstable home life, Like, I was like, sign me up with Ducky. That guy's going to give me the love that I don't have for the rest of my life.
Well, let's just jump into it. Okay, so obviously my biggest thing is, like, I felt like the ending was very, very rushed, and we didn't really get a solid set of relationships. But let's just talk about the teams, okay? We're going to talk about what team we are. What team should Andy have been with at the end? You know, you have Team Ducky and Team Blame. Now, this movie originally had Andy ending with Ducky, but test audience did not like that ending, so they reshot the ending, which could very well be why this movie has a very rushed
test
ending.
Audience.
Right, mind you, this has a higher audience score on Rotten Tomatoes than an actual score. But test audience said, no, we want to see her with Blaine. So they went and they redid the ending where she ends up with Blaine. And this has caused quite the controversy, because now you have two separate camps, Team Blaine or Team Ducky. And people will say that they're part of Team Ducky or part of Team Blaine. So we're going to settle the debate right now here on Flashbacks. Who should Andy have ended up with? I didn't say more about my problems with the script, because I want to hear from Jay and who he says, because I love that he says this person, and this is, I'll say my part after he's done. Who should she have ended up with?
Team Steph all the way. He's got money. He's showing his chest off. Always got a cig in his mouth. Probably the coolest guy I've ever seen on the screen. Hunky, hunky James Spader. Give it to me. Team Steph all the way. He sucks. He's so terrible.
Not a choice, but a solid choice nonetheless.
He's such a dick. I'm a Team Blaine. I'm a Team Blaine guy, because Blaine's a good dude. He's a good dude. There's a lot of peer pressure apparently in the rich community.
Okay, so here's what I was going to say
about that. But I'll say this. She felt that pressure too, because like her friend was very much, and like she had an internal struggle of being like, do I go with somebody who's rich? Like, can we do that? And her friend was like, super put off that she would step outside of her social class. And that does happen. That's a thing. The crabs in a bucket thing is real.
Yeah.
All right. So if he's Team Blaine, then that means our one and only Aaron is who? Team who?
Listen, I am a little more hesitantly than I was before this recording.
You were pretty adamant. So just lay it on.
I was pretty adamant until I watched it and realized, you know, 14-year-old Aaron was a hot mess.
You just like the hat.
I love his style. I still love his style. I'll die on that hill. I will die on that hill. I'm Team Ducky. I'm okay that she ended up with Blaine, but I think that he was super annoying and inappropriate and way too intense in the beginning, but he did show maturity and growth. He did the right thing. You know, he made the move that was best for Andy and not just for himself or him being left behind. So it would have been nice to see them together, but you know, he gets Christy Swanson at the end. So
he gets the vampire slayer. So it's fine.
He gets the vampire slayer. So, you know, good things come to everybody in John Hughes movies.
All right, so
what about you?
Before I say what team she should have went with, I'm going to say this about Steph. I wish we would have seen the interaction between Steph and Andy and the rejection, you know, because there's not much there. You know, it's this big selling point, and he's a big villain, and it comes out that Blaine figures out that she wouldn't have him. Well, I wish we would have seen that or had Andy explain that story to Blaine. Or even at the end, whatever, because that would have given Steph more depth, more character depth. But
so you're saying more than just the little part in the beginning where he hits on her and she rejects
calls
him.
Her bitch.
Yeah.
So
yeah, he did.
So that's how you score a relationship. You call somebody a bitch. So
that's
moving on. It's very 80s of you, James.
That is what has always worked with me.
Right. I am Team Nobody. I am of a mind that she shouldn't have gotten with Blaine or Ducky. You know, she should have found herself, realized that she was worth more than someone who's going to put a label on her like being poor. I know that Blaine didn't, he came around at the end, but still, know your worth. Like, if he's not going to see you for who you are, see you later, bye. You know, John Hughes writes amazingly strong female characters, and then he kind of missed the mark on this one.
Is he pretty good at female empowerment?
Not with this movie. Because she went right to a guy that basically shamed her for her background and who she was. So I am team nobody. I wish Andy just would have said F it and just ran off into the sunset with Iona and done Thelma and Louise, which we'll talk about for our next episode. All right. Does anybody else want to say anything in terms of improvement or the wacky ending that we got and you know, put the age old debate of team whoever?
Yes. No? Like three or four less shots of the goddamn train. We get it. She's on the wrong side of the tracks.
All right, let's talk about impact. What impact, you know, 35 years later, what impact does Pretty in Pink have on our film society or just on our lives? We'll go Jay.
I think it's a part of a greater whole. I don't know that Pretty in Pink itself. I mean, I think it's just added to that, the 80s era of teen movies. And what John Hughes did. And I mean, that's the gold standard era of teen movies, and everything, any teen movie now, there's some comparison to those movies always. So I don't know that Pretty in Pink itself, but I think when you add it to the list of those teen movies, I think it's, I mean, I think we all know the Brat Pack, the John Hughes movies, the Molly Ringwald movies. I mean, when you talk icons, you know, there's the Brat Pack, and then there's Molly Ringwald. Like she's outside of the Brat Pack for the 80s as far as
there's Ringwald's ring.
Yeah. and John Hughes too. And he went outside of that world, but he was so good at writing teenagers talking, dealing with problems. And this movie had problems. I also wonder too what this movie would have been like if John Hughes directed it. And I think it would have been goofier and funnier. Yeah. And I genuinely think it would have been more enjoyable. He's got a goofy sense of, you know, it's silly. He's got a lot of silly type of humor stuff that really works with his dialogue and the problems that he puts people in.
Can I ask a question though? Like, do you think they wanted do you think they wanted a goofier question or goofier tone with, I guess, the like socioeconomic class thing they were dealing with?
He got away with it during Breakfast Club.
I was gonna say, I think Breakfast Club is a much better breakdown of, you know, the class demographic and socioeconomic status. And I think it was a much better breakdown and got more into it.
And the best part about it, the best part about it is it wasn't very upfront with it as we were with Pretty in Pink. It was very subtle in Breakfast Club.
Well, right. And you don't exactly, but this seemed, it was like the whole
worst on you
whole movie, her whole life. And I think maybe was that intentional because it did encompass her life.
Yeah.
Not that it didn't for those kids in the Breakfast Club, but you're dealing with five people, whereas this is just really the life of one girl and how it affects.
Yeah.
I don't know. Aaron, okay.
Did her dad ever put a cigarette butt out on her wrist or hand or whatever Bender says in Breakfast Club?
Look up, Johnny.
Aaron, what do you think about impact when it comes to Pretty in Pink 35 years later?
Oh, Pretty in Pink. What can I say?
Got a good soundtrack.
Got a great soundtrack. But okay, I mean, really, I think Pretty in Pink adds to the films of a couple that come before it that kind of, I don't, like, this to me feels like it sets the tone and the template for some of the 90s teen exploitation movies, like She's All That. I think 10 Things I Hate About You in the 2000s draw influence from it. Especially with like the relationship with Blaine, you know, and 10 Things I Hate About You, the guy who's, I think it's Andrew Keegan, is like the meanest to Kate Swallow's character is, you know, it's because she was with him, like, and there's strife there, she rejected him. So I think this movie definitely influences and inspires teen movies past it, and also I mean, this is like now every teen show, every teen movie has got the dance, right? The prom, the winter dance. It's the centerpiece of the universe of every
that takes teen 5 minutes.
Yeah, exactly. But like, you know, you get the same scene too, the like fall, the music, the falling down, the scanning the floor, seeing everybody dance at the tables, like, you know, so it's definitely left its mark on this genre of films past the 80s. And so, but other than that, like when you look back and you kind of listen, I don't know that everything in the movie, the relationships in and of themselves, the way that they're depicting some of the social problems, like, I don't know if that all translates over.
Yeah.
35 years later. What do you guys think? You got a pulse on this, Ryan. You're a school teacher.
I mean, I don't necessarily, I mean, being in the school, I don't necessarily see it as how pronounced that it was in Pretty in Pink, because they shoved it down your throat. I mean, I just see kids, you know, but I you know, the scene with the teacher, you know, I almost related to that. I'm like, I almost did that a couple of times with students, but I'm like, I didn't, because I know what that means to the person being bullied. So in that sense, so, but my overall impact, Aaron, I'm gonna have to agree with you 100%. This movie definitely sets an archetype for a lot of teen dramas moving forward. You've got, especially movies where you've got, you know, somebody who is secretly in love with someone, although Ducky was not secretly in love. He professed his love every moment he was on screen.
There was no secret about his love.
And no.
Aaron loved that.
But just the conflicted female character, you know, who do I go with? Who do I decide? You've got the mean girls. You've got, you know, a guy with an ulterior motive or an ulterior motive to hate. But I think this just also solidifies the fact that John Hughes knows what he's doing when it comes to writing teenagers in Chicago, because all his movies are in Chicago. So it just really kind of solidifies that John Hughes is the real deal. You know,
can I point something out about that Chicago bit?
Yeah.
This one did not take place at Shermer High School.
It did not, but it's still Illinois.
But I saw a bus with Elgin. What else?
One of, I saw one the old school Illinois plates. So that's all I need.
Meadowbrook High.
Meadowbrook, yeah. I saw all that. I was like, hey, that's not Shermer. What the hell's going on here?
Well, if you've seen where the rest of those movies take place in Northbrook, you would understand that the south side of the tracks wouldn't have been shabby enough.
We're back to the damn tracks.
You could have gotten that.
Yes.
But yeah, I just think this movie solidifies John Hughes. It solidifies Molly Ringwald as the 80s star. It really introduces Andrew McCarthy. He was the last one on the bill, you know, and also starring last one, you know, Andrew McCarthy. So it kind of shot him up. But yeah, I mean, a lot of these people really went off and did great things. You have a DC villain and a Marvel villain.
You have Weekend at Bernie's. You have Weekend at Bernie's 2.
So, but you got a DC villain, you got a Marvel villain, you got a vampire hunter, and you've got, you know, the mom from Secret Life of American Teenager. So there's that.
And Steph sets the tone. I mean, I think he sets the archetype for nefarious.
Oh yeah, for sure.
High school villains moving forward as well. Paul Walker and She's All That. Yep. Yeah.
Paul Walker in Varsity Blues. Actually, he was a pretty good guy in that movie.
He was a good guy in that one.
Real quick, though, I know I've mentioned, but can we talk about how sexy James Spader is in this movie?
Okay, so for our next episode,
Patreon,
Jay's going to go ASMR and speak directly into the mic about his love for James Spader.
James Spader is amazing.
You have to go quieter. You have to whisper.
He looks so good. Okay, Jay, little fun fact for you about JS. He doesn't have great eyesight and he can't wear contacts. So some of that like smoldery closing up of his eyes and squinting where he looks cool is actually just because he can't actually see the person's face that he's talking
to. He can't see the cue card.
Listen, He has bad eyesight, but he's so cool he won't even wear glasses. That's what I'm saying. That's what I'm talking about.
All he's got to worry about is making sure his shirt's unbuttoned. He's got a cigarette in his mouth. Done.
Sweet ride.
All right. Well, Pretty in Pink does not have any sequels that we can do a sequel ranking. But we can ask the question, where does this lie in terms of your favorite John Hughes movie? And I'm going to say, I'm just going to lay out a simple question. Is this in the top five of your favorite John Hughes movies? I'm going to go first. I'm going to say no. You know, you got Pretty in Pink, Breakfast Club, Home Alone. I mean, he's done other things. Pretty in Pink is definitely not in my top five. Jay, what do you think?
Yeah, it's on the lower end. Let me just say it's below 16 Candles, but it's way above Weird Science.
See, I love Weird Science, dude.
Okay. You guys had a reaction after rewatching this one. You might want to go back to Weird Science because I just watched it 2 weeks ago.
Jay is like, Ryan, set some drinks aside for yourself.
I think you're going to be surprised.
Is Bill Paxton still funny? And does he?
Well, he's in it.
Does he still turn into a gelatinous mobby creature?
He looks like a giant talking turd. That's a character in the movie.
Okay, hold on. On a scale of seltzer water to straight gin, what does Ryan need to watch Weird Science?
Oh, just a beer.
Three fingers.
Oh, okay.
All right, Aaron. We saved you for last because I feel like this is going to be in your top five. Is this in your top five when it comes to John Hughes movies? Don't forget Ferris Bueller.
Oh, listen, dear. I have not forgotten Planes, Trains, and Automobile. I have not forgotten Curly Sue. I have not forgotten Uncle Buck.
Curly Sue.
So, that being said, this is not technically, it's a movie written by John Hughes. It was not directed by him. So I don't even know, even though
it's semantics. Really, you're talking semantics now.
I don't know that I would include it.
Aaron found the loophole.
A teen movie starring Molly Ringwald, written by John Hughes, and you're not going to consider it in the John Hughes canon?
We already had the conversation where I talked about how I feel about the Brat Pack. I don't include everybody.
I consider a John Hughes movie if he wrote it.
Okay, that's fair.
Basically what I said.
he reworded it in a way that I liked. You pulled my loophole, which sounds inappropriate now. So,
we're fine.
I don't know that this would be top. I don't know that this would be top five. It's top 10.
Okay.
Well, I don't know that it's top five.
All right. Well, that's going to do it for our great talk about James Spader. I mean, Pretty in Pink. Thank you for joining us. We hope that you have a great Valentine's Day. But before we go, we want to let you know what we got coming up for the Front Row Network. Aaron, go ahead.
What we got is some more podcasts on James Spader, maybe just for our Patreons, and maybe for James Spader himself. And for our second episode in February, we're going to be doing the 30th anniversary of Thelma and Louise. What about you, Jay?
Well, Larry Smith and myself are continuing to work through Cobra Kai. We had our first episode get posted last week, and we'll when we're not dropping movies on Tuesdays, we'll be dropping episodes of our discussion on Cobra Kai. So keep an eye out on that on our feed. And now I'm going to be thinking of interesting names for our James Spader podcast. Maybe listeners can feel free to see our email in the show notes. Send us a note. What should we call our James Spader podcast? Spader neutered, something like that. I'm thinking.
Coming up, spades.
Ace of James Spader.
Oh man. All right, well, for March, we're going to go full St. Patrick's, and we're going to discuss what The Departed could have been like if James Spader was cast. Just kidding. We are going to go to Scotland and we're going to discuss the world of the immortals with the 35th anniversary of the cult hit Highlander.
There can be only one.
Thank you for listening to Front Row Flashbacks, and make sure to tell your friends to check us out. Our pod is on any number of podcast apps, so look us up and please subscribe. While you're at it, if you really dig what we do, please join us as a full-time patron. Our Patreon link is in the show notes, and we would love for you to give us your money. I mean, to be a part of the team.
And be sure to look up the Front Row Network for any of our other content, like Front Row Classics, with hosts Brandon Davis and Eric Flick. Hold on a minute. We've got a guy on this podcast with the last name Flick.
He legally changed it for the show because that's the dedication we bring people at the Front Row Network.
Well, that's amazing. And just as amazing as some of our other shows, such as Guilty Pleasures, hosted by Lou Hare, and our Beyond the Mouse crew that covers all things Disney and so much more.
In short, we have something for everyone at the Front Row Network. Make sure you find the Front Row Network on Facebook and subscribe to our main feed on Spotify or whatever you use to access your podcast. We can also be found on NPR Illinois' website under Community Voices, and you can follow us on Twitter at Front Row Reviews with a Z. For the Front Row Flashbacks, this has been Ryan Lutens,
Jay Hoffman,
and Aaron McCabe.
And we will see you all in the front row.